was amazing then for, you know, the movie and your knowledge of mythology and all that stuff.
Yeah, thanks. Yeah, I teach it, so it's kind of always right here, you know.
Oh.
So, yeah, what? And it's...
Because your knowledge of mythology is way better than mine. It was actually the first book my father used to read to me from Greek mythology when I was like 2 years old. It's when I was 11, and he read some of the stories but I never studied it, you know, formally or anything. So I was impressed with your, you know, and the way you tied it all together. I don't know if I'd necessarily do that, but I see you.
I think a lot of people don't tie it together that way. And I think a lot of people, and actually one of the things that interests me is how men and women tend to view the film differently. That's another aspect of it that, that I'm interested in, you know, in kind of how people, because women pick up on certain things in the film and men go, oh no, you know, like Marco and I had this discussion when I actually wrote the piece. Cause he's like, oh, come on, you know, the biblical allegory is so obvious. And I'm like, is it? You know, so I don't know. It wasn't as obvious to me, but it was obvious.
No,
to
I agree with you on that point. Marco, do you want to start, or you just want to let us roll?
Oh well, actually, we're waiting for somebody. I just bumped into our intern Natalia. She lives on the street, and she was just getting back from the road trip. And I said, "Hey, we're about to start that podcast," because she's been working on the piece, gathering artwork and photo imagery for the material that we're publishing. And she also watched the movie, and she's an aspiring filmmaker or somebody who wants to be involved in creating films herself. So I told her to just hop on, and she doesn't have to really, you know, participate if she doesn't want to, but if she just wants to hang out or if something occurs to her to say. She said she watched it with her mother. Just recently on her trip, and so and that gave her mother nightmares, so that would be another interesting perspective to bring into the mix, I think.
Sure.
And we haven't actually used Zoom before, like I haven't tested it with her, so she's trying to get on now, I guess. And we could just wait for her. And then I do have an introduction. I have an idea for how to start things off.
Okay.
And then could let you like introduce yourselves more formally. Like, Bridget, you're a professor of mythology, blah, blah, blah. Mark, you're a unfamous novelist, interlocutor, participant on the forum, Infinite Conversation, whatever you want to say. But you also have, you could mention your training as a psychologist or whatever else is relevant, really, to the conversation. And
then, you can just read my introduction again.
Sure.
Why?
Hey, Natalia.
Hey.
Hello.
So, I don't know if you can see us or not. We can't see you. That's cool. Whatever you want, you can do audio, or we're on video. You're welcome to, but you don't have to.
I just did the phone call.
Okay, that's cool. So we're here with two people, Mark Jabour and Bridget. You want to say hi?
Hello.
Hi.
Hello.
Okay, this is weird because I got two people on video, one person on audio. So I'm going to
throwing you off here.
I'm going to try to shift between, you know, like modes. Anyway, Natalia, how to begin? You're our intern. You're a summer intern, and on metasarcosis.
Are you in Oregon?
No, I'm right down the blocks, not even a block. I'm two houses down from Marco.
Oh, and he won't let you in his little pod, huh?
This is like my God studio here. this is where I write my poetry and
maybe I'll burn it down.
Yeah. That's right.
This is where I sink into my self-absorption. So, all right. Well, let's just chat for a moment because I'm not yet like comfortable enough to like start a podcast.
Okay.
So yeah, Natalia background was our babysitter for a summer or two, and has since graduated and started college, and that's kind of where maybe we pick up the story, like how you get involved with metempsychosis. You want to just a little introduction, and then we can move into the into the talk.
Sure. Basically, I just ran into Marco one day, and I guess he just had thought of, I guess it just came up. I don't think he was thinking of it before, and he just thought that he could use an intern, and I was saying that I wasn't really up to anything much for the summer. I've been pretty free, just kind of not even going to college for anything particular yet, just taking some general core subjects. Don't really know what I want to do at all. And so I was like, yeah, I'd like to intern. It sounds like a cool, just it's like any kind of learning experience, really. And it's even more cool. And he kind of told me a little bit about it over coffee. And it just, I like visited the site and it just seemed really awesome and just really interested in it.
There was an intermediate step, and that's that video project that you were doing for a class. And
oh yeah.
That like opened up a certain conversation, I thought, like about education, about like life, about, you know, things like if you're a young person looking to do something creative or do something meaningful in the world, like how do you even begin to do that? And so we're homeschooling our daughters. So my wife Kayla and I have two daughters. One is 8 and the other is 4. And so like I've, you know, I'm giving a lot of thought, not just within the context of this bigger project, but even in the context of my home, into like how to create an environment or a human context where like, these young people whom I love, right, my daughters, can grow up to be happy and creative and, you know, free people, which I know from my personal experience has been a struggle, you know, going from a childhood where I was educated in a, let's say, a kind of factory model, you know, what we call the factory. It wasn't that bad. I mean, they were good teachers. The facilities were good. It was a middle-class suburban kind of neighborhood. But when I think back to how they actually approached my mind as a young person with some, you know, intelligence, some curiosity, you know, a child is full of potentials, right? And those could be channeled, those could be amplified, but they could also be totally like ignored, totally neglected, totally squashed. And you could be kind of rewarded for other things that are more useful to the society that you're living in, like getting good grades so that you could be a good employee of a business down the road or whatever. I mean, we had this whole conversation basically, and it's been for me the like impetus behind doing these kinds of podcasts and conversations here, because it's like I want to open up more of a space for actually talking about what is of significance in our lives and in our contemporary world and in our reality. And a lot of, you know, the stuff that you hear is exciting, like on the media or in the news or even like people that are talking about culture a lot of times is just not that deep, and it's not that relevant actually to you know what is of concern to us. And so I guess I saw like like in Natalia that she's interested in learning, and I'm interested in learning, and you know, I'm in a few years ahead and have done some different things, but wherever I notice that kind of desire to, you know, grow or to create something more, I want to nurture that. So the internship thing is kind of a joke, because it's not a joke in the sense, like just the word internship, like the concept of internship, because this is not a college, or I don't feel that official. Like, I don't feel like I have, you know, the authority.
We're official. Yeah. Come on, Marco, we're so official.
But for her, she could put it on her.
It'll look good on a resume. It will.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's it. So
on my CV, what the heck?
Interned at Metapsychosis.
Depending on who's reading this resume, of course, and what you're looking to do with it. You might want to be selective on where you include this particular thing in your CV.
There's no shame in it. It's good.
So, this is the first project that we've been working on with Natalia. And as I was mentioning before, she's helping find imagery. She's also an artist. She creates art. And so I suggested that maybe you will get inspired and, you know, create something, but that's, you know, not up to her even. It's the kind of thing that comes through. Let me kind of try to frame this. I watched Mother a few months ago in the winter time. After it had been recommended by a few people, and I watched the trailer for it, and I was intrigued because it seemed like this is a complex, multi-layered, philosophically deep and interesting, like mythopoetic, spiritually powerful film. That was what I thought it might be. And when I watched it, I felt like it delivered on that to some degree. And the question was, well, what does it mean? Because I had read a few interpretations suggesting that there was some allegorical elements. I picked up on some things that, you know, touched on things I know about mythology or the Bible. Certainly there are themes that are masculine, feminine, male, female relationships. There's something about God and the earth and humanity. It struck me as a very ripe film for diving deeper into and getting like other minds involved in picking it apart and trying to discern, learn what it's actually saying and what it means. And I think that that's sort of like the fun part of a good movie, is that it allows for a lot of interpretations. So we did a talk a few weeks back. I think it's been almost a month or two now, probably a couple months with Yeah, so the idea, let me back up again. So I thought, well, let me kind of see who would be interested in that. I wrote a post on the forum and a few people replied. And then based on who replied, I thought, well, maybe let's do two conversations so that the participants have more time to talk. And I ended up getting sick, so the exact like symmetrical configuration that I had worked out in my mind didn't actually manifest, but actually kind of, maybe it has accidentally now in this call, but we did a talk with J.F. Martel, Caroline Savory, Jeffrey Edwards, John Davis, and myself, and I was just sort of holding back, so I didn't say too much. And then both of you, Mark and Bridget, watched or listened to that. And in addition, Mark, you replied on that forum topic, and Bridget, you wrote a piece, an essay called the mythology of Mother.
Mm-hmm.
Mythology of Darren Aronofsky's Mother, which we haven't yet published, but is basically just about ready. We're going to be publishing it concurrently with this.
That's what I figured.
And so Mark has read your piece. Mm-hmm. So have I, and actually so has Natalia. Mm-hmm. I don't know if I want to start there exactly, maybe just with a little bit of a review, but I would be curious about what you kind of think outside of the piece too. Brigid, from mm-hmm. the themes that you've raised that you didn't explicitly write about or maybe only touched on in the piece.
Oh, and, dear.
And then I'd also like to hear what Mark's take was, who is coming from a different, you know, background and is going to have something different to say. But before we do that, I would like to start with a poem.
Okay.
And this I found just this afternoon on one of the reviews that I was looking at around Aronofsky's movie. And so it's a poem that is like a play on the prayer, "Our Father, who art in heaven, hallowed be thy name." And this poem was handed out on little postcards to folks that attended the premiere of the film at the Toronto Film Festival. And supposedly it was personally requested by the director that this poem be handed out to people attending. So here it goes. It's called Mother's Prayer. Our Mother, who art underfoot, hallowed be thy names. Thy seasons come, thy will be done, within us as around us. Thank you for our daily bread, our water, our air, and our lives and so much beauty. Lead us not into selfish craving and the destructions that are the hungers of the glutted, but deliver us from wanton consumption of thy vast but finite beauty. For thine is the only sphere of life we know, and the power and the glory forever and ever. Amen. And that was written by Rebecca Solnit. And
I know her of her.
Adapted by Rebecca Solnit. So how about Brigid and Mark, can you introduce yourselves and then maybe we could talk about Brigid, your piece, and then some of the other perspectives that are in the mix.
Okay. I'm Brigid Burke. I actually do a number of things. I'm a librarian, but my main context for this is that I am I teach mythology. I teach religion at Montclair State University. And I've been interested in it my whole life, actually. Myth, religion. I mean, I probably read my first book. Mark and I were talking a little bit about, you know, reading Greek myths as children. I certainly did that, but I also was interested in religion from like the age of like second grade. I think I took my first book out on that. So that's kind of been a lifelong thing. And the teaching thing, you know, I ended up I have a master's in religion and psychology. And I have a doctorate in literature, but my doctorate's actually the dissertation that I wrote is actually about life after death and how it affects our view of the feminine in particular. Okay, so that's kind of been my area. And what I've discussed, what I feel is that when you start to have salvation theory and you start to have an idea of being saved from something or saved from death, that this has a negative impact on your image of the earth and of the feminine, which I think is, I mention it because I think it's somewhat relevant to what we're talking about here, maybe not just somewhat. And so that's sort of the context and the background that I'm coming from. And and I've taught for like, I think probably, good God, probably 15 years now. So it's been quite of a long time. That's sort of my interest and my perspective coming into this piece and looking at this film, which I don't see just strictly, I mean, which I agree is a biblical critique and a critique of Christianity, but, I think it's a lot more as well.
You're also a writer, right? You write
mm-hmm.
stories.
Yes. I write for you guys. I'm hoping to have, my, revised dissertation come out. I write fiction. I have short stories out, working on a novel. So yeah, there's quite a few pieces in the works, and I've had some chapters published in different places on themes very much related to this. So
cool.
Yeah,
Mark, how about you?
Let's see. Let's start with education. I really have no complaints. I am a military brat, so I grew up. All over the country and also in Europe, and went to you know, a school every couple of years. I changed schools. And then I started college in 1968, Colorado State, majoring in anthropology. And I lasted a couple of years. This was during the Vietnam War. And then I left college and went on an adventure that lasted years and years, doing many different things, including building my own home, starting businesses. I've done cabinet making. And then I went a lot of things. And then I went back to college and got a degree in psychology and went into the mental health field, children specifically. And then that was interesting. And that was the late 90s. And then I went to graduate school at DU in social work. And I left that. I wasn't satisfied there. And I built and opened a bookstore. And that was right coincided with 9/11. And I had to shut the bookstore after a year. Then I moved to Oregon, wrote a novel, came back to Colorado, wrote another novel. Then I got a job teaching creative writing here in Westminster at Front Range Community College. And I left that a little while ago. And I'm working on another book about the election of 2016, which is, I'm nearing my second rewrite completion. It's getting together. And Marco might do a cover shoot with me. So that's where I'm at.
All right. So let me start with Bridget's piece. You address the idea that the film, Aronofsky's film, is a biblical allegory, contains biblical allegory. But the main thrust of your piece, as I understand it, is that there are deeper layers to that, or there's ways that that's really made dramatic or complicated because there are other layers of mythology that are underneath or deeper, not as well known as the biblical. So you talk about the archetype, the archetype of the feminine in particular, as a container, as anima, mm-hmm. and as the terrible mother.
Yes.
You talk about the house as a symbol for a representation of the psyche, mm-hmm. a metaphor for the psyche. Hospitality and fame, you go back to that and how the ancient Greeks looked at hospitality. And how that theme of hospitality, let's say unwisely offered or abused, mm-hmm. is a part of this film. I thought one of the most interesting mythological stories you brought in was that of Dionysus and the mm-hmm. Bacchanal, and this idea, this way that these scenes, these primal scenes of throwing off all inhibitions and orgies of violence and lust and warfare and all these things that we see in the film being, you know, having something to do with Christianity, but really even precedence to that. So those are just some of the highlights for me is reading your piece. But like, what was your, you know, including all that, what was your take on this film?
I felt when I watched this film that it was, it's one of those films that if you look at it strictly from a narrative standpoint, okay, where you just look at this as a story moving from A to B to C, it really doesn't make a whole lot of sense. I mean, to me, I'm looking at it and I say, okay, this is kind of an attempt to portray an archetype. That's the way I see it. And that's just, you know, how my thoughts are, you know, skewed or biased towards the idea.
Could you say something about archetypes just for, you know, folks who maybe don't know Jungian psychology or?
Sure, absolutely. Archetypes, Jung's definition of an archetype, it's kind of I always think of Adolf Bastian's term, elementary idea. Okay, it's sort of a concept that seems to be part of human consciousness and human culture universally. Okay, so when we talk about, for example, the trickster. Okay, tricksters appear in different cultures. The Senex, or the wise old man. Okay, this sort of figure of age and wisdom. In this film, of course, we see feminine archetypes, and the feminine archetypes, well, mother is one of them, okay? Mother and father are certainly archetypes. And concurrent with that in sort of psychological development is the idea of anima and animus, okay? And in Jung's thinking, the anima is the soul of a man, and the animus is the soul of a woman. And that's the opposite of what you would think, but his idea is that biologically you may be one thing, but your soul is the opposite of that. Like there's a sense of trying to balance out opposites there. So for a man, the anima would be sort of that creative spirit. Okay, that would be that feminine that's both dangerous and seductive, but also that is inspiring at the same time. If you think of the goddess, I think they call it, let's say Circe, it's Circe, but Circe in the Greek, who turns Odysseus's men into pigs, you know, but then he, you know, ends up having a relationship with her and she ends up guiding him through things. She's a perfect anima figure, okay? And when I watched this film, again, with mother being the theme, okay, mother is the title, and Jennifer Lawrence's character is the sort of central character. When I look at mother, she embodies all of the elements of that archetype. In other words, she's passive, okay? She's not, she does take action at certain points, but generally that's in relation to her child, towards the end, you know, when she gets angry and she sort of fights back, it's in relationship to what happens to her child. She's nurturing, but she's also destructive at the same time. So it's kind of this full embodiment of femininity in both its creative and destructive kind of forms, which for me was also reminiscent of Hinduism because, the Hindu gods, like Shiva, of course, is sort of he's male god, but he's sort of dual sexed in the way he behaves, you know, there, but there's him and his wife, Shakti or Sati or Parvati. They're very, it's very much about creating the world and also destroying it at the same time. So I feel like there's a lot that's going on here on kind of this archetypal level, and that's what really jumped out at me as I'm watching the film. I'm watching and I'm going, oh yeah, there's that, oh god, look at that, look what they're doing there, you know, that's what really stood out to me.
What about you, Mark?
Well, I was introduced to it through this website, Infinite Conversations, I think through the cafe or something, and so I hadn't seen the movie at all, but I listened to everybody talk about it. And there were, a half a dozen of you or something. And so what I did was a factor analysis of all of what you all thought. And I ran it through the elements of a story. And the elements of a story are title, plot, setting, characterization, style, which is the voice of the author, and themes or big ideas. And I weighted it. I gave them all five. People would have different weights to those six elements. And I came up with you guys kind of came together. I put it all together and figured you gave them 21 out of a possible 30. That'd be the highest score you could score, would be a 30. And that'd be, a B minus, something like that. And then finally I bought the movie through the cable company.
You watch B minus movies?
Like Bridget said, I'm not a big movie goer. I don't see many films a year. But you know, I hadn't watched this one now. So, and now I've watched it three times. I watched it twice, putting my thoughts together, and then I got Bridget's paper, read that, and then I just finished watching it again. So, but I see where she's coming from, and I see all those connections, but I think she's giving the author way too much credit. I actually would rate this a zero as far as a title, plot, setting, characterization, style, voice, and themes, big ideas. I'd give it a zero all across the board. And I can go into further detail, but what I really think the movie is a vehicle for Jennifer Lawrence in a way for, how do you say his last name?
Aronofsky.
Aronofsky.
Mm-hmm.
It was basically, and men do this a lot, was basically a way for him to almost, the movie almost, I think, is autobiographical, in that he wanted her and he needed a way to get to her, and this was the vehicle he did it. The opening scene is very sexual. Jennifer Lawrence in a t-shirt. And I think if you would do an analysis, her face is the most that comes on the screen, and it's always takes up the whole screen. Most of the other characters, most of the time, it's about, you know, they're in it with part of something else. Her face fills up the screen. The next thing would be a tie between the back of her head and her breasts. And I bet she takes up, I don't know, I'm just guessing, 60, 70% of film time. And she has almost no dialogue. It's all heavy breathing and you know, looks of wonder or horror. Now, I'm not a horror, I never see horror movies, so maybe that's standard fare. But I definitely see the feminist, why it would appeal to the feminist, because in the end, she gets her revenge. And I also think that maybe it's a nightmare. In the beginning, she says, baby, and because there's all those surreal elements to it. And then at the end of the movie, she wakes up again and goes, baby. So maybe it's a nightmare. As far as I don't know where he got the plot. Well, the plot, I think, is a young woman inspires an older man. And that's a common element of true life, I think. But the young woman's values are children, home, and the children. And that's sort of, Bridget, you use, call it archetypal. I look at the characterization as stereotypical.
There's a relationship there. I mean, because stereotypes do come out of these kinds of...
Sure.
Stereotypes are a little bit more cultural, I think.
But yeah, when you're telling a story, and I look at it through the elements of a story, the characters, usually the protagonist, there's some depth to them. But these are stereotypical characters, all of them. Or you can say they're archetypal, and they are, but they're also stereotypical. There's no depth to the protagonist, the mother, Jennifer Lawrence, who just walks around, like a doormat, with her mouth open, breathing heavily, and trying to please her man. It's mm-hmm. I'm sorry, it's awful, the movie.
Well, just if I could just comment on that. Well, the one thing when it comes to Aronofsky, yeah, whether or not, I mean, certainly from a plot perspective, it's pretty weak. I mean, we're not, I wouldn't disagree with that at all. But that's why I tend to see it as more archetypal. Now, one of the things about that, though, is that there's not necessarily an intention to be archetypal there, because a lot of times, well, it's kind of like the literary idea of what they call fallacious intent. It's the idea that we see something in a work and the author never intended it. You know what I mean? So we try to ascribe a meaning to what the author says, but the author themselves, they could have written it for whatever reason. They could have just, you know, like you said, it could just be about his own feelings about women. It could have to do with his own or his own.
This particular woman, you know, they yeah. got in a relationship.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Oh yeah. Oh yeah. It worked. It worked. I don't mean to interrupt, but this is very important. It worked. They got in a relationship. And I would not at all be surprised if it is autobiographical, that he was frustrated in his work. He was also probably impotent. And yeah, well, this is psychological. This is what creative people do. And like you said, they're not even aware they're doing it. And
right.
But out of fairness, so that's speculative.
On the movie tour, sort, you know, you write a novel, you go on a book tour, they also go on like a movie tour promoting it.
Right.
And he was just narcissistic, talking about how great it was and everything. And so Jennifer broke up with him.
Interesting. I met him once, actually. I met Aronofsky in London once. Yeah. Yeah.
He's like 49. She's like 27.
Yeah. I mean, no, I don't know. It kind of fits. I'll just say that. But it's, yeah, I don't know. I mean, yeah, there's probably that dimension to it. Again, I think if you kind of look at it on the level of biography, I think I've been a little, just this is just my thing, I'm a little wary sometimes of reading biography into people's work, although it could be there, only because I took an entire class actually on poetry and biography. And so we were looking at poets like, for example, Sylvia Plath, where we think, oh my God, you know, that's absolutely loaded with personal biography. But there's some interesting critiques of that where they say, you might want to be careful reading too much biography into it. Or Robert Lowell, for example, you know, there's a kind of thing of like, oh wow, this is about you and your manic depressive illness. And Lowell's just kind of like, okay, wait, yeah, but that's not really where I was going with this. I always used to kind of read things that way myself. And I think after I had taken that course, I was like, okay, you know, there might be reasons to say let's just say that's probably not I wouldn't see that as the primary interpretation. Let's put it that way. Even though it might be there, I tend to kind of think that, okay, this could be there, could not be there. Like Marco says, it's kind of speculative.
The impotence part.
Total speculation.
The other parts I think are probably there, but I think I know where you're going with this, but just it's like a reduction to the biography. Reduction.
Yeah,
to
you want to be careful doing that. Yeah, I mean, not that all those elements aren't there. I agree that when you mention that, I go, yeah, okay, I could see that totally, but yeah. I don't know that that's, I do think that though there are other layers to it. And I think film, maybe because film is a kind of a medium where you can work more in image and in just things that are more implied rather than said, you know, because when you write a story, there's a certain level of description that you have to create images with words. And here you're not, at least in this film, you're not using words so much, even though the main male character is supposed to be a poet or some kind of a writer, but most of it just seems to, I mean, there's dialogue, but most of it just seems to take place in what's implied or what's, and that's just the whole thing about her character. It's passive. And that is sort of the yin yang femininity. I mean, it's the yin is passive. It's just an expression of something that just kind of sits there and observes, but doesn't necessarily actually take an active role. And that's what I definitely see going through, is that she's just kind of moving through the film. There's also a helplessness there. She's just kind of moving through, and stuff is happening to her. And of course, she's also blamed for a lot of stuff that happens too. You know, she's kind of seen as inhospitable by man and woman. She's seen as, when people approach her and she says, you know, no, I want my space, get out of my house. They call her all kinds of names. You know, she's kind of it's like she's passive, but she's almost like a punching bag, or like you said, a doormat in a way. She's just kind of there. And
there's that scene where they have an argument too, right? And
yes.
Okay. And he says, you keep this house as like this
suffocating
place, right? Like, mm-hmm. I want to open up the doors. I want new life into this place.
And her interpretation of new life is, yeah, I'd like to have a baby, but I don't have one. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Well, they conceive the baby during a violent confrontation where he says almost, you know, yeah, you care about the house and nothing else. And she says, you're worthless. You can't even write. You haven't written a word. And, you know, and then they, oh, then yep. that's when they conceive the baby. I mean, come on.
As a plot point, that's pretty weak.
Well, if you just run down the list, and again, I'm looking at it from a story.
Sure.
But from film shooting, if you just the shots of her breasts, I bet it's 20 or 30 minutes of the film. In the back of her head, he follows her around with the camera, and she's breathing heavy and turns around, her mouth's open, and it's just, that's a film.
But Bridget, I think you're saying that there's deeper layers to it, not just the personal psychology. I mean,
right.
The archetypal is not a character necessarily. Like, an archetype doesn't have a personality.
Right. It only has the personality that you project onto it. That's what it is.
So it's I think that's actually appropriate. I mean, because it is an allegorical film. Whether it's an allegory strictly for the Bible or relating to the Bible or has much more to it, which I'm convinced by Bridget's paper that there's more to the film than perhaps even Aronofsky really meant for there to be there. But that's, I mean, if it's just about his personal, you know, libido, then that's not art. You know, that's just...
Exactly. So, but I don't think it was intended. I think, and Bridget mentions this in your conclusion and somewhere else in the paper, that what it is it's a hodgepodge of mythologies. Little of this, little of that, little of this. It was like he was trying to say something, but he didn't even have any way to say it himself, so he pulled... It's just a hodgepodge of old stories, and it's confusing because, yeah, he uses this over here and this over there, and I don't think it was intentional. I think he was groping for a product.
Well, I think actually the Jennifer Lawrence thing is interesting, your point about their relationship, because typically what happens when you have someone who's creative and has a muse of some sort, there is a projection onto that person of all of that kind of stuff. And it may well be a hodgepodge, you know? It may well be a collection of different things that you don't even know how they connect, because generally that whole process is not a conscious one.
And you mentioned that in your paper.
Yes. I teach a class on love mythology. And one of the things that I teach is I teach Eros and Psyche. And to me, that's not
what,
like most
Psyche?
People... Eros and Psyche, Cupid and Psyche, the one about...
Cupid.
Cupid, yes. Eros or Cupid, depending on whether you're doing Roman or Greek. And that in that particular story, there's this idea that he falls in love with Psyche and he takes her away. And supposedly she's married to this monster, but he's invisible. And so she can't see him, but he seems really nice, but she can't see him. She's in the dark. And everything's kind of going along, but she's kind of lonely. And then her sisters come to visit and they go, hey, wait a second. You know, you're supposed to be married to this monster here. And so she gets upset and scared. And so then she goes to finally confront her husband with the lamp and with the knife. And then she spills wax on him. He wakes up. She sees who he is, finally. And then he takes off. And then all of her suffering begins. And inevitably, my students will say to me, they'll say, you know, if only those stupid sisters hadn't come and intervened. And I'm like, no, yeah, that's the point. The sisters have to come and intervene. Because your relationship is totally unconscious. He's just this image, this invisible thing, person that you make love to and you don't know anything about. You're just kind of an amorphous image. Once she sees him, now she knows who he is, and that's where the suffering begins, because real relationship involves some kind of a work. It involves some kind of suffering. It involves encountering both the positive and the negative about a person, because generally what you project onto the person is not the person, okay? So what people tend to fall in love with is their own image of what they think the person is and not the actual person. And real love lasts when you get to know the real person and, you know, and you're able to put that image aside. So that's, to me, I'm just looking at this as a set of, these are images, these are archetypes, these are not real people. These are not real people interacting with each other. Even though they represent, like you say, you know, they could be stereotypes or they represent some kind of cultural idea.
Well, I would just take issue with your statement that it's not real. It is real. The projection is real.
Well, it's not.
It's common.
No, it's a real psychological phenomenon, but I'm saying is that I don't know that the two of them actually know each other.
Well, and we've had this conversation in the cafe about reality and getting to know yourself, I think, in the cafe, and personality and just, some of the papers that people don't know who they are. It's pretty hard to love someone when they don't even know who they are.
Right.
And so but they're real. Real.
Well, they're not, when I say real, I mean, are they real in the sense of, when you see something in a person, are you seeing who that person really is? Or are you seeing just what you think you want to see? You know what I mean? Right. And then they have a reality or a validity, but it's not that.
So okay. There's a relationship here between mm-hmm. the Jennifer Lawrence character, the mother character, the feminine, and the Javier Bardem character, the him, the poet. Mm-hmm. Some call him the God character. And they don't really know each other as people. There are no other people. There's nothing even to, at the very beginning of the film, there's nobody even to compare themselves to, nobody to reflect who they are. I mean, they're in a sort of primal state of just moving into this house that they've reconstructed in the middle of a large open space, natural area, perhaps reminiscent of the Garden of Eden. And it seems that, I mean, one reading possible is that they have to let in the world. They have to let in all of the depredations, all of the confusion, the chaos, the violence, the suffering of the world in order to come to know themselves through this, the process of the movie. And I actually think there is a coherent, or what could be, I think, there is a coherent arc to this film. There is a coherent structure to it. And I think just to abstract away from this particular Greek myths or even the Christian myths, there is, I think, the concept of the earth. And that one like core archetype of the Mother Earth. This is found in cultures, right, all throughout the world. We refer to the earth as the mother, as that which has given birth to us as human beings. And another motif common across cultures is there also being a sky god. And these two poles, earth and sky, are often associated mythologically, mythopoetically, religiously with the feminine and the masculine. And so it seems to me that these two characters are representing those two archetypes or those two poles they're kind of in their initial innocent state. And then the process of the film is the corruption of that state, the way in which it turns to chaos and death and destruction because of these sort of core flaws that are there in that initial relationship. And that is, those flaws are the narcissism of the man, the narcissism of the masculine principle, who seeks to create from nothing, seeks to create from an ideal, right? The ideal, I think, is represented by that crystal figure that he has. This is an ideal that's been forged out of, you find out later in the film, through this sort of recursive temporality. It's forged out of the suffering of the mother, the suffering of the feminine, but it's solidified and it's abstracted away from it. It's not the beating heart, which she feels in the house. Like, she has these moments where she touches the walls and she falls into a kind of trance and the wall disappears and it turns into like the inside of a beating heart. It's not that. It's not alive. It's dead. It's beautiful. It reflects light. It has this one complex structure, but it's a dead object. And he uses it as a kind of totem for his creativity because he wants to be an author. He wants to be a creator. And the flaw on the feminine side, I think, is what you named, Bridget, as that passivity or that sort of like lack of boundaries, lack of being able to maybe claim a self in the way that the masculine figure claims a self and writes his poem and accomplishes something and then has his ego fed and amplified and aggrandized by the adulation that he receives from his fans and friends and followers and who become the faithful. Mm-hmm. So I think you can read this as an allegory for the human experience, like for the for humanity growing or developing from a state of more primal innocence, where we were closer to nature, we were just differentiating from nature, to the state we were in now, which kind of comes through the agricultural revolution and the axial religions, and then, you know, more recently, the last 500 years, the birth of the modern world, of humanity coming to want to be the author of it, of the world, in a way that is totally divorced from, disrespectful of, and destructive of the natural matrix from which we came. So I think that it is a hodgepodge of religious stuff. There's biblical stuff, Greek stuff, Indian, Hindu stuff. It's all kind of there. And I having listened to a couple of interviews with Aronofsky, I think he was conscious of some of it, and some of it is intentional. And not of all of it, but not of all of it. But I think he is telling a story about humanity and our relationship with the earth. And that's why I think he gave out this poem at the beginning of his reading, because this is another take on our Father, but it's one that is not ascendant and moving away from the earth. It's like descending and embracing the earth. And I think he's trying to communicate that in a sort of ideological way. I think like that's his idea, like that he wants people to get. He wants people to feel or see in this concentrated, intense, disturbing film experience, like how cruel, destructive, foolish, stupid, and narcissistic and self-involved we as humanity has been. And I know he's an environmentalist. He's like on the board of Greenpeace, the Sierra Club, I believe. He's kind of concerned about global warming and things like that. But I think it goes beyond just global warming. I mean, it's not just a few, you know, the change in the atmosphere. It's the whole attitude and the whole relationship that we have with Earth and with the feminine mm-hmm. which sees, which, you know, sees it as a means of, you know, to have a, you know, to exploit, to use up, and to to disrespect in the pursuit of one's own selfish aims. I think that's the message of the film.
Well, just to comment on the biblical thing, and that's one of the things about the biblical view, perhaps, versus the other, is that in the biblical, Joseph Campbell had said this. He said in the biblical worldview, there's this idea, if you read the Adam and Eve story, it's the idea that nature is corrupt. Okay, nature is something that has been corrupted through this quote-unquote sin, which happens to be lust, which happens to be committed by the woman, and that therefore it needs to be repaired or fixed or redeemed or improved upon in some fashion. And I think that kind of going along with this very logos-driven culture that we have, you know, this idea. One of the things I notice about him in her passivity, he becomes excited by a guy who's an intellectual, and he's a doctor, and he comes in, and he starts talking to him, and, oh, now I'm inspired. And she says, well, I like your work. He's like, yeah, okay, yeah, you do. And he just kind of moves on, because there's this idea that it is very intellectual, rational, and like you say, individualistic. The collective is kind of shunned as lacking in any kind of character, lacking in kind of individuality. And when you talk about the collective, there's always this sort of fear of the collective. You're going to be swallowed back up, you know, from dust you came and to dust you shall return. I mean, you're going to lose your sense of self and who you are if you allow yourself to get swallowed. You know, that's what you were talking about, the passivity there. There's this idea that she's just this sort of, you know, the container, the idea of the container. And the fact that he's a writer and the fact that there's all of this kind of other stuff and you want other people and you want stimulation and conversation, I don't know that there necessarily has to be a value judgment about it, but there's certainly a sense that there's an imbalance there. Okay. That it's too much driven by the one and there's not enough attention to the other. And yeah, it leads to the same kind of result, I think, that you're talking about.
Well, she does become an agent at the end of this movie, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Action. I think his the underlying theme, I think, is the from a feminist perspective, he's trying to be and I don't even know the word, you know, a modern feminist, but a man. He's he's painting the man and society as bad and evil and just, you know, the mob and the man, that's all the bad stuff. And the woman is taken advantage of and used but in the end, she gets revenge.
I have to say, I cheered during that scene when she blew the place up.
I'm not gonna lie. It was written, and I don't. I'm curious. I mean, you film writing, usually a page is 1 minute on the screen, and you have your dialogue. There was very little dialogue. Most of it, like I said, was following her around, either from the front or the back of her head, or these close-ups, you know, beat, but almost a blank page.
Yeah, and I think that kind of, yes, I agree. And I think that's kind of what I'm talking about when I talk about the logos part of it. The fact that because the film is called Mother, like when we talk about the biblical allegory, I said, well, it is called Mother and not Father, you know? I mean, so if you were going to try to
be called He.
It could, well, I mean, I wonder though, because that element of passivity there is a, and I say feminine, I don't necessarily mean, that's the other thing too. The terms feminine and masculine don't have to apply to men and women respectively. I mean, we all have masculine and feminine attributes. And they're just simply described in that fashion. But the passivity is something that I see as, that's a very feminine thing. And like you say, that's the pervasive thing throughout the film, is this this passivity, this that breathing, the seeing the breasts, seeing the, you know, and yeah, there could be a sexual component to that, but it could also just simply be, it could be also riffing on the image of the mother too. You know, when we see the mother as sort of the great.
Well, that is the archetypal image of the mother.
Right. Yes. It's the
first carvings and stuff were like a just almost a head and some breasts.
Yeah. And probably, yeah, an exaggerated sort of round body features. Yeah, exactly. And so there's this, there's definitely that, that element of that. But yeah, but
that, it doesn't stop there because there's the Shakti element that comes in.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
So it's not just passivity. I mean, that's one mode of it. Maybe that's like the ideal of femininity that we've adopted in the modern world.
That too, right? Yes.
Mm-hmm. And he tears it down at the end when Bridget applauded, when she gets her revenge.
Yeah, that's what they call the quote unquote terrible mother, okay? Which, you know, because that's the mother, that's like Kali, okay?
In today's feminist culture, and that Rebecca, she's like the vanguard of the movement almost. it builds up to that, you know. And then,
but don't you think it's right? I mean, isn't there some truth to this? I mean, you're speaking about feminist culture, feminism, as if it's just some ideology, and that there isn't a truth to.
There's obviously a truth. I mean, it's obviously real, and I know lots of men who fit that description. I have my own name for them. You know?
Yeah, well, it's the different aspects of the feminine, because passivity is one of them, but what Jung and what Neumann and these others refer to as sort of the terrible mother, terrible only in the sense of frightening.
But okay. now it's the warrior, it's the Wonder Woman. I thought that was a good movie. It's the ghost in the shell. Is that it? Yeah, where the protagonist is a woman.
But you know what, though? Honestly, I think that it's funny you were talking about this, because I actually had this thought this week when I was doing some writing. I was like, you know, we always think of war as being a very masculine thing and warriors. I said, it's actually a pretty feminine thing. I mean, you've got like, I've been writing about a war goddess called the Morrigan, okay, in ancient
there
Irish.
You know.
Athena. Athena is the one who drives the action in the Iliad. I mean, Ares is there, the war god of war, but then they get in a fight and she beats the heck out of him. You know, I mean, I think of war as being actually quite a feminine thing, and that kind of, that kind of pushback, or that kind of, it's not necessarily, we tend to think of it as masculine, maybe stereotypically.
But it's fashionable now, it's in vogue for that warrior woman to take charge, to not be passive anymore, mm-hmm. right?
And that may be part of the culture now, too.
Yeah.
Part of the cultural shift that we're having now, on one level,
On one level, but there, I mean, I don't know how much we want to get into feminist theory, but there's, you know, like multiple waves of feminism, and there's a critique from one wave of feminism toward the prior wave of feminism that by emulating, you know, masculine kind of ideals, you're really not liberating, you know, the archetype or the essence. And there's even a critique around essence, like, you know, whether or not it's accurate or true to describe feminine identity according to an archetypal kind of schema. Would it not be better to leave it open to, you know, what the individual woman or, you know, person, you know, however they identify, wants to define themselves? I mean, there's some real, I think, issues here. Like, I think he touches on some real cultural nerves, and because the film is so complex and baffling, I think many people maybe won't really be able to think through all that or really make sense of it as much, because there's so much going on. But I think that's actually how it is. That's why I think it's a good film, is because the personal stuff, the interior psychological stuff, I don't think is separate from the cosmic stuff and the theological stuff. I mean, if the way that we relate to, you know, the cosmic reality, infinite reality, real reality is colored by our individual masculine or feminine or mixed psychologies, but our psychologies also are ways that we relate to the bigger realities. Like, they're kind of portals. Like, you know, we do live on an earth. we do live under a sky as human beings, and these do have their effects on how we orient in time and space. Like we do suffer, right? So there would be a natural even reaction around rejecting what you think is causing your suffering. And if you think the body and the earth and nature is the cause of your suffering, it's understandable. I'm not saying it's right or philosophically true, but it's understandable why you'd want to escape beyond that and kind of transcend into another reality, into an ideal reality that you can order with your words and kind of set, like, make better than the very messy sort of chaotic one that you live in. So, I mean, I think we could look at this not like we have to look at it actually, like, on multiple levels. And that's what I think makes it a good film, actually, that it lets you do that, as, like, evidenced by these conversations that we've had, because, you know, we've had, for every individual, there's been a reading, and each individual has themselves had kind of like multiple readings. So I would like to ask Natalia, if you're still there, since we've been talking for a while, if you have any thoughts or reactions, anything. I mean, I told Bridget and Mark about your trip and the fact that you watched the film with your mother and that she had nightmares. That's as much as I told them. But what do you think about all of this?
Well, yeah, I love Darren Aronofsky from his other films. And I first saw it when you suggested me to. And I had no idea what I was, like, I came out just totally confused. And then I watched the podcast, and I got all the different viewpoints from that. I still am not totally sure, but I see a lot of the archetypes. The last time I watched it, I kind of just remembered, who is the girl on the podcast?
Caroline?
Mm-hmm. Caroline. Yeah, what she was talking about, like, the mother being, like, Mother Earth or something. And so I kind of just tried on that viewpoint and saw it, like, Mother was kind of the Mother Earth and the house was kind of Earth. I don't know, that's what I saw. And, but then what I was just looking up Darren Aronofsky, and I didn't know that he was actually in a relationship with Jennifer Lawrence. That's really interesting. And they actually, part of what ended their relationship was that he was so obsessed with the film and he wouldn't stop talking about it. And she said, we'd be on the tour together. I'd come back to the hotel and the last thing I'd want to talk about or think about is the movie. And he comes back and that's all he wants to talk about. And I was doing double duty of trying to be a supportive partner while also being like, can I please, for the love of God, not think about Mother for 1 second? I just thought that was really interesting and kind of a lot like the film. And I see what both of you are saying, and I do see that, like, it does seem to be like a reflection of his own inner workings, and I'm not sure that he really knows what the film is supposed to be about. I'm not really sure. But it does seem like there are those archetypes in it. And yeah, that's what I think.
So
it's interesting. Sorry, go on ahead, Marco.
No, you please.
Oh, okay, well, I was just going to say, to that point, yes, and the fact that he's been so obsessed with the film, I think, to me, that's kind of a testament to just how archetypal it is, because that's usually how archetypes manifest in people, is they manifest as kind of obsessions of a different kind, or almost psychotic kind of episodes. So it's just very interesting to get that sort of background on it, because I thought, yeah, you know, it seems like that does kind of add to the point that this may be, you know, I mean, it has something to say on a more universal level, but it may also be about where he's going as well.
portrait of an artist obsessing over his work. I listened to a podcast interview he did, and he mentioned that when he wrote Mother, he was actually working on another piece that wasn't working, like it just wasn't coming together, and Mother was in kind of like gnawing at him, like he wanted to write something, he had something in his mind, and that was what he used to like put aside the other project, and he threw himself into a room for like 5 days and created this film. They did rehearsals for 3 months, which apparently is a very long time in the film world. You know, it's expensive to have actors' time and crew and so forth. They took like a year making the film. So he really put a lot of personal energy, time, and a lot, you know, money went into it too. Not a huge budget, apparently.
A lot of time with him and Jennifer.
Yeah, they had time to develop, and I think he was looking for something from her. Like
she may have been in his head from the beginning, from the get go. Not even on a conscious level.
Yeah,
this thing may go way deep.
Yeah. But that's the thing with art. I mean, you can't.
Yes.
Art doesn't just come out of, you know, like the mind. It comes out of
the person. It comes out of the person. It's a reflection. It's a representation of the artist's view of the world, whether it's conscious or unconscious, whether it's a painting, a book, a film. I think maybe the most honest artists are the singer-songwriters. They're not hiding much of anything. They just, sometimes you wonder, well, who's she talking about? But the singer-songwriters, they put it out there. Painters, novelists, filmmakers, my goodness, who knows what they're up to.
Well, the song has to come through you. You know, you have to, your whole body has to be in a song if you're singing it. I think with a filmmaker, you can step back and create a lot more artifice. You can create a lot add a lot more screens and illusions. You can't really lie when you feel something and a song comes through. It's hard to lie about it.
And I think, film is I admire the craft and the amount, you know, I couldn't even begin to think about how to look at the credits, and there are hundreds and hundreds of people.
You have to be obsessive to do involved. To be a film director. I mean,
to write a novel, all you need is a piece of paper and a pen.
You have to be a little bit obsessive too, to be a novelist.
I agree with that.
Natalia, what was it like watching this film with your mother?
honestly, mostly just funny because she had even less idea than me what was going on, and she's just asking questions the whole time, like completely confused. And she had nightmares after, actually. She thought it was really disturbing.
Mm-hmm.
So, I don't know, there was no, like, I didn't have
You didn't interpret it.
You know, I think that...
I started barely interpreting with her after, and then she was like, we could talk about it tomorrow, because she could tell it was gonna be a long conversation. I'm not sure if that's her thing, but I talked to my friend who I've seen it with twice a lot about it. She was there with me the first time and she saw part of the podcast as well. And we were both just looking at the symbolism in the film, just the little things, like thinking that every single shot or every single thing is meant to be there, whether it is or not, and just trying to really dig into, like, why is the, why is there a bee that, like, falls dead on the window, and just all these little things. And Yeah, I'm still not completely sure. It all seems like everything I'm hearing sounds pretty, like, could be. So I'm really not sure what I think about it.
Well, what do you think, and this is an open question for anybody, about the very, very end and the fact that it seems to start over again? Like, Mark, you gave one, I think, possible and plausible interpretation that it's a nightmare. But putting that aside and presuming that it's about reality, it's something that it's about what's actually happening in the real world, the waking world. Circles back on itself. And at the end, Jennifer, the mother, she blows up the house. It all goes down in flames. And then he, the poet, is carrying her dying corpse to where exactly? Somewhere carrying it.
I think it's outside.
Outside in the middle of the field, puts her down. And I forgot exactly what they say in this moment, but he reaches into her chest and grabs out her beating heart. And that's what in his hand forms the same gem that reappears later. And then as that happens, you know, the life kind of snuffs out of her. And then you see her wake up and the whole house sort of implied is going to be reconstructed. And the whole thing implied is going to happen again. So, I mean, one of Caroline's points in the last talk we did is that she wasn't sure who really was in control at that point, because it seemed like she burned down the house, but she wondered whether her character was being, in a sense, written by the poet, by the God figure, and at the same time, whether if he was writing it, even he was really in control of the script, the bigger narrative, because he seemed to be trapped in this loop. What did you make of that aspect of the film, this kind of like time loop that is at the end and I guess at the beginning?
Well, I don't know. I tend to look at the time loop as, again, there's this idea, this theme of the eternal return, you know, that things continually... it's that notion that, you know, creation and destruction are very closely linked. Okay, so we know, you know, so death and birth and death and, you know, are really kind of two sides of the same coin. There's certainly that, perhaps maybe fairly obvious motif there. As far as who is in control, that was interesting. I remember Carolyn saying that on the other podcast. And I, you know, and that almost makes it, that's almost a very meta thing. It becomes like chicken and egg, you know, it's like, you know, well, wait, which one? And I don't know that, I think it raises the question. I don't know that there's really an answer. The whole business of her being brought out into the field and having her heart taken out. I remember that. You remember that book by Shel Silverstein, The Giving Tree?
Yeah.
The kid's book? Yeah. And I remember talking about this book.
Oh, yeah.
What's that?
My friend said that reminded her. That was in the podcast, wasn't it? Was that, or?
Not The Giving Tree. I don't think we mentioned it before.
Or did you just think that?
I think.
Oh, well, I just thought that. I was thinking about it because
my
friend
said that.
Mm-hmm. Your friend said the same thing?
Yeah.
Interesting. Okay.
Interesting. Yeah, because I took a women's studies class and when I was in undergraduate. And I remember them bringing up that book because, you know, we'd seen that book as a kid. You didn't really think anything of it. You read it and it was kind of portrayed as kind of this nice story. But I remember my professor saying, she's like, no, what is this? It's just like the woman's just supposed to give and give and give and nothing has to be given back. It's just sort of like, you know, your role there is just, you know, well, you know, you've destroyed every aspect of me. Just take what's left. And now you can go sit on what's left. It kind of falls into that same idea of the feminine as sort of like eternally giving, but not expecting to get anything in return, which again sounds like selflessness, but it's really more like exploitation. You know, there's a critique in that as well. But and part of that eternal return might also know, because we don't really know, we only see the film starting over again. We don't know if we're talking about a true eternal return. That was another question I think that was raised. Is it going to be different next time? And if, the guess would probably not, because people never seem to learn from the past. So they kind of do the same thing over and over again. It does seem to run. And that would be archetypal as well, because archetypes run on, that's the idea, they kind of run on automatic script, if you will. And that we don't really, we play them out very, very unconsciously. So if you were going to follow that theme, that would be my way of looking, that would be one way of looking at it anyway.
Yeah, I thought it was kind of cynical, actually, that ending.
I think it's when writing a story, the ending is always the hardest part. It's hard to end a book because life doesn't end. So it's really a gimmick when you do something like that. Again,
comes down.
But also, I have watched a while ago, Black Swan, The Wrestler, and Requiem for a Dream, and I believe I had positive feelings. You know, I thought they were good films, all three of those. So,
yeah,
you know, I'm not totally. I think the guy was just, you know, this one's a hodgepodge with a lot of gimmicks in it.
All right. That's great. Any final thoughts before we end this? I have to go take care of something for my wife before I promised that I would do
something. We're coming to the end of the time anyway.
Honeydew kind of thing. So any final thoughts?
Well, I think this is kind of interesting because remember what I was saying, right? I was talking about this with Mark in the beginning, and I don't know if this sort of made it into where we're at, but I was talking about how different it is that men and women tend to see the film somewhat differently. And it's very interesting because I like Mark's perspective because it's just, I mean, we've talked about all kinds of things. We've talked about all the allegory and the mythology, and he's kind of looking at it kind of more from this sort of narrative stereotype kind of perspective, which, you know, it's like, okay, well, you know, that could be part of it. That adds to the picture. Certainly. But I don't know. I still tend to think, you know, I think it has its strengths and its weaknesses, like a lot of things. Like when we had the biblical allegory discussion, I said, you know, I don't know if that's all it's meant to be. That's pretty weak. You know, that's my take. Because I just kind of say, yeah, it doesn't really follow through. But I don't know. I still would tend to say that there's... that part of the reason that it just doesn't make sense and doesn't hang together is because it's talking about something that doesn't, in our conscious sense, really make a whole lot of sense, except the sense that we try to find in it.
And we didn't talk about this, and I think this is where the people cling to the biblical, is the brothers coming in. I mean, that's almost like this a separate story, but... Oh yeah, Cain and Abel, you know, and it doesn't really, does it add anything? And you're right about the funeral, it just seems to go off the rails then when the brothers get there.
I'll say, since we're, this is my last thoughts here. I like the chaos because I think that reality right now is chaotic. That's how I experience it, and that's how I think a lot of people are experiencing it. And so the fact that for 2 hours you just get hit with one crazy image after another in this kind of vortex of destruction, kind of what it feels like to be alive right now, at least. That's what I'm tuning into, and I, you know, found some really interesting reflections in the film. And they weren't all coherent. They weren't, you know, they didn't follow an orderly narrative, but, you know, I'm sitting here in my little writing studio, just like the poet in the film. And I can't not see myself in it, you know, even though it, of course, wasn't written for me particularly. I think the fact that you know, I can see something in it. I think a woman who, or anyone who you know, feels more feminine can feel themselves or see themselves in it. Somebody who really cares about the earth and who sees that part of it, you know, and sees the way that the earth is being despoiled by, you know, modern technology and capitalism and whatever else you want to, you know, throw into this brew of like dystopia, right? This dystopian brew. I think you could see that in it too. So, and because it's so disturbing, I think that was one aspect of it, the emotional intensity. Mm-hmm. Maybe it makes people think, you know, maybe it makes them more sensitive to like what we're really doing to the earth. I think that there is truth to what he's saying, even if it's a political kind of message. And that's always tricky with art, you know, is bring an ideology into it. There's more than just the global warming debate. Like there's something more, I don't know if he would go here. I think he identifies more as a scientist, but I think there's more, it has more to do, at least for me, with like your spiritual state, by which I mean like the whole set of your attitudes and beliefs and the way you actually relate to people, like the way you actually are in the world. And you know, people just live as if this is, as if the world, you know, could just be rebuilt, you know, by magical technology, or, you know, by a corporation or a government. Like we could just do whatever we want. We can take whatever we want and there are no consequences to it. And I think that that's a false belief. I think that that's a really ignorant belief. And I think he's saying something like that. That's like one message I get from it. And it's not just about changing your politics. You have to actually be in a different relationship with the earth. And maybe masculine and feminine have to be in different relationship with each other, between people and within people. So I found it useful on that level, and more than useful, I found it affecting on that level. So I appreciate the opportunity to talk about it with everyone, and I really enjoyed everybody's perspectives and ideas and stories and interpretations. And I don't know, probably all of our conversations are a big hodgepodge too, but I don't think we have to take fault for that, because that was kind of inspired by the movie. Anything from you, Natalia?
I kind of related to what you said, actually, in that I kind of took it as, like, for myself, like, I kind of wanted to see, like, what, like, I was kind of just getting something out of it for myself, and I'm not sure if that was actually in the movie, but it'll kind of just happen to me when I watch movies, is I'll kind of see some sort of lesson on whatever particular thing I'm dealing with or that's in my head. And I guess I got from it that, like, I related to, like, the poet who's going out of his way to create, and I'm not even sure what exactly it is that he created, because it's just some sort of circular, like, idea. Like, I'm not, like, his poetry is just, it's just a circular, endless, like, nothing of she brought life into the house, and that was beautiful, and to create sort of endlessly. And that just seems like I could see in myself, like, wanting, like, just that sort of artist viewpoint and neglecting, like, just like relationships or other things that are actually more real and important. So that's just my final thoughts of what I kind of got out of it.
I like that. Yeah. Me too. That was the thing with my wife. Like, I feel like I should go and take care of, you know, be with my family instead of being out here, you know, making art, whatever we're doing. But the thing is that, you know, I really need both. I really do. And like, that's how I feel. Like, and It's about the balance, and so things get out of whack. I hear, you know, either my soul starts clamoring for attention, I'm like, get everybody to get away from me, like I have to go create something, or my family starts clamoring for attention and they're like, you know, we don't even know you, we don't see you, like, you know, why don't you talk to us? Like I totally experienced that. So I think, Bridget, I like your point about balance, and Mark, I like, you know, the psychology you brought into it, and we'll post this and see what other people think. Please, if you're listening to this or watching this, you can comment on the forum at infiniteconversations.com. Read Bridget's piece on the mythology of Darren Aronofsky's mother. That's going to be on metapsychosis.com. And if you have something you'd like to add, just post it to the site, or send us a message, send me a message. If you have, do your own podcast or your own take, we'll add it to the hodgepodge. So thank you very much. And see you all later.
Okay. Go be domestic.
Bye-bye.
All right. Bye. Nice talking to you.
Nice talking with all of you. Nice to meet you.
Nice to meet you guys.
Okay. Bye.
Okay. Bye. Bye-bye.